From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The U.S. Senate gears up for a historic trial of President Trump. Five men have been sentenced to death for their roles in the gruesome murder of the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Tensions between the U.S. and North Korea increase, and we'll look back at 2019 and preview the new year, 2020. Well, let's start, Linda and Tom, with this impeachment trial of President Trump. I think, as our global listeners probably know, the president has now been impeached by the House of Representatives. That, of course, is the lower chamber of our Congress. And he'll be tried at some point in the new year in the Senate. Of course, the issue is we don't know when this trial will occur. We don't know what the trial will look like or if anyone will testify. So a lot of things up in the air. Linda, let's start with you. What do you think is going to happen?
Right now, we're at an impasse. So Nancy Pelosi has not handed the articles of impeachment to the Senate, which would then allow them to announce the terms for the trial. So this is all a matter of discussion, should be, between the majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, and the minority leader, Chuck Schumer. In our last impeachment with Bill Clinton, the two Senate leaders were able to work together and get a deal together for a trial of Bill Clinton. This time, it's not happening. Nancy Pelosi is using what little leverage she has and withholding the handing over of the articles. It might look like she has no leverage. The Republicans have the majority in the Senate. But what she's done is gotten under Donald Trump's skin. He has spent the Christmas holiday in a rage tweeting at Nancy Pelosi over the fact that she's not triggering the trial. There will be a trial, but she's holding off to try to get a better deal in terms of the terms for this trial.
And one thing that is an issue here, Tom, is that Mitch McConnell, of course, the Senate majority leader, has already said that he cannot be an impartial juror and that he's cooperating closely with the White House. Well, that hardly seems like a fair process. And they've been complaining about the process, and yet that hardly seems fair.
Well, the truth of the matter is the way the protocol works, Paul, is that all senators will have to swear an oath before anything begins to be fair and impartial jurors of the president, any president. And it's hard to see how McConnell can do that because he's already said, I'm not impartial. So that sets up a bit of a back and forth there. It tells you a couple of things. It tells you, like many Republican senators, McConnell, who is up for re-election in 2020, should be cruising to victory, is scared to death of crossing President Trump, getting on President Trump's bad side. So he has a tightrope to walk, but it suggests that the Republicans don't care, and whether there'll be a backlash at that point somewhere down the road, it's too early to tell. The procedural problem the Republicans have, as Linda said, you need two-thirds of the senators voting to throw out a president, meaning 67. It's very unlikely that that will happen. So nobody really thinks that Trump will be removed from office, but you only need 51 votes to prevail on procedural things. And so if the Democrats can find four Republicans to say, we need to have a witness. We need to hear from Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who is, the Republicans think, did bad things and when he was on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. The Republicans would like to hear from him, but Democrats say we have to hear from John Bolton, the president's national security advisor, who was right in the middle of all the Ukraine stuff and was pushed out. And so far, he's not been willing to testify. So a threshold of four votes is not that big. So we'll have to see what happens.
And it looks like there's perhaps at least one Republican, Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, who has expressed reservations about what McConnell has said in terms of not being impartial, but who might the other three be? Is it even possible there are three others?
It's
Mitt
possible.
Romney, maybe?
Romney's a possibility. He's as close as you can get to being a never-Trumper and still
two.
Stay in the Senate. There's Susan Collins of Maine, who's up for re-election and is in the battle of her political life to hold on to her seat.
Cory Gardner, a Republican from Colorado. Colorado has become more and more of a Democratic enclave. Mm-hmm. In the last decade or so, and he and Collins are considered to be the most vulnerable Republicans running for re-election in November of 2020. So that gets you to four. Now, will that happen? We don't know, but Republicans are torn. I mean, I'm sure Linda can speak for herself, but I'm sure we all know of situations where we've gone up to Capitol Hill and talk to Republicans who say, well, we're really troubled by this president, but we have to back him because if we criticize him, he will destroy us. He will unleash the power of his very formidable conservative base.
In other words, they're not troubled enough.
They're not troubled enough to show any profiles in courage, but it's
early. And the Democrats could lose some votes, too, don't forget. You've got the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, who represents the most Republican state in the country.
Doug Jones in Alabama.
And Doug Jones in Alabama, who's probably a goner in the next election. A Democrat in the Deep South, kind of won on a fluke. So, honestly, I just don't see the Democrats really getting to 51.
Well, we'll talk more about this, I think, in the second half of the show when we preview the year to come. But let's move on. In Saudi Arabia, as people perhaps know, five men have been sentenced to death and another three face a total of 24 years in prison for their roles in the gruesome killing of the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Last year. There are some people who say that this is actually kind of a sham here, Tom. I mean, they were convicted, sentenced to death. So how would that be a sham? What's going on?
Well, first of all, the trial was closed to the public and to the media. There was no transparency. We don't know what kind of a trial they got. The two closest advisors in the chain to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Sultan were cleared of any culpability on the grounds of insufficient evidence, but there's no record of what the lack of evidence was. It's a sham because, and this is not a personal opinion, this is a fact. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency a year ago had concluded with a very reasonable degree of certainty that Khashoggi's killing and dismemberment was ordered personally by the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Sultan. That is not personal opinion on my part, that is the fact that the CIA and other American intelligence agents concluded that Mohammed bin Sultan was personally responsible and culpable. And he, of course, has denied it. It's a heinous crime. I had nothing to do with it, but he's not very credible. And so that is the problem for the Saudis. They can't admit that the leader of their country has participated in a criminal act, a murder. So there is a giant cover-up here. There's no way to sugarcoat that. But I think MBS will survive, but it'll be interesting to see over the next year or so what happens on the global stage about this. The United States is still in his corner for geopolitical strategic reasons, but again, there are very few people in positions of authority in the U.S. intelligence community who don't agree with the CIA that he is culpable.
All right. Well, Linda, in the remaining minutes we have in this first part of the show, another thing that I wanted to talk about, tensions between the U.S. and North Korea have suddenly begun to rise again. The president, as you know, has spent the last couple of years. He's met with Kim Jong-un three times now. He said that the denuclearizing, we know, or at least U.S. intelligence agencies say that, has never been the case. I continue to work on their nuclear program, on their long-range rockets, and so forth. And you know things are kind of deteriorating when sort of the name-calling starts to ratchet up. And the president just recently reused his phrase, a rocket man, when talking about Kim. So this appears to be kind of a going backwards here.
Yeah, and Kim promised a Christmas gift for America. And so we sat here on Christmas wondering if something terrible might happen. Now people are looking to Kim Jong-un's birthday, which is January 8th, because that is for North Korea, a big important day. So we're looking as that might something happen by then, and what the top officer for air operations in the Pacific region is looking at is he's expecting some type of long-range ballistic missile to be the gift, a test. Not a good thing.
We were talking about John Bolton a couple of minutes ago, Tom, and Bolton, I think Twitter, which is, seems to be everybody's medium of choice these days, Bolton has said, well, at some point, President Trump is going to have to admit that his strategy, everything he's done with respect to North Korea from day one has failed. Is that a reasonable? That's what John Bolton, again, the president's former national security advisor, has said. Is that a reasonable assessment?
Well, it's a reasonable assessment, but it's not a reasonable expectation. There's nothing in President Trump's DNA that suggests he can or will admit a mistake. It's not, he's just not wired for that. He's always on the attack. It's interesting to me that the love letters seem to have stopped. It's been a long time since the president has said, I got the most beautiful letter from Kim Jong-un.
He said, we fell in love.
Yeah, we fell in love. I think, I don't know why the chill in recent months. Maybe it's because the president has now understands that there's no way North Korea is going to give up its greatest global bargaining chip, nuclear weapons.
It's the only thing they have.
Right. And without them, they're just a country that's starving its people and are international pariahs. But they're international pariahs with nuclear weapons. So this has gone south, that's for sure.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. Well, this is our final program of 2019. Where's the time gone? It's just the year has flown by. It's the end of the year, in fact, the end of a decade. And as we look back at this year and ahead to 2020. Well, let's talk about 2019 first. It's almost impossible to think of all the things that have happened this year. It just happened so quickly. But Linda, we'll start with you. Mm-hmm. The two or three things that have stood out in your mind this year.
So I'm just struck by the role of Nancy Pelosi. We began the year with her having to fight for the speakership, which even people who opposed her rise to that position for the second time, of course, she was the first female speaker a decade ago. And then when the Democrats retook the House in the midterms last year, she was positioned to retake, but faced this revolt among some younger, more progressive members of Congress. And she won the speakership back and has proven herself to be the most skilled politician, the most skilled tactician in Washington, bar none. She gets under Donald Trump's skin. He doesn't know what to do with her. He's finally giving her nicknames, but she doesn't care. She raised five children, and any mom knows that when you raise kids, you learn to put up with a lot, and you can see through the stuff that they're throwing at you. And I can't think of anybody better be facing off against him.
In a way, it's almost ironic that Trump polls poorly with women, of course, and is not going to do well with women, I think we can presume, in the 2020 election. And here he is being undone so far by the most powerful political woman in the country, no question.
And every time he launches on her, he used to say to aides and friends, I respect her toughness. Linda is right. She has gotten under his skin like no one else has been able to. And every time he launches on her and calls her wacky and crazy, and I mean, he probably loses another 1,000 votes from suburban women who didn't like him much anyway. I mean, her strength She's the only person in America at the moment who can rattle him, throw him off his game.
Mm-hmm. And she's just cool as a cucumber. Three just keeps throwing these name callings. And you're right. She doesn't care.
I mean, she comes out and she says things, and I think it's heartfelt. I pray for the president every day. Well, that sends him into orbit, and he sends this remarkable, very long letter to her right before the impeachment vote, in which he is just kind of excoriating her. Sentence after sentence after sentence, came across as a very intemperate, unpresidential letter. And he also accused her of lying when he said she was praying for him. That is going to be a continuing duel in the next year, setting aside the election, which we'll talk about. I mean, the Pelosi back and forth with Trump is really going to be a duel of the titans.
So that was one thing that Linda said kind of stuck out for her this year. What about you? What was sort of the top thing that you...
Well, to me, it was the coalition around Trump by a Republican Party that really doesn't quite know what to do with him, other than the fact that they have to bite their lip, bite their tongue, and support him. Because the Republican Party lost the off-year elections in 2018. They're worried, many of them are worried about doing poorly in 2020, but they cannot break with Trump because they see what has happened to other politicians who have broken with Trump. Most of them are out of office. A couple of them were defeated in primaries when Trump supported somebody else because he was angry with them. A congressman from South Carolina is one of them. And so what I would call otherwise sane and principled Republicans have said, I want to be in the Senate and the House for a long time, but I've got to get through 2020. Because if I can get through 2020 without incurring the wrath of Trump, I have a chance to be in Congress a long time helping people in my districts or my states. So the coalescing around Trump by more moderate conservatives in the Republican Party is one of the more striking political developments of the year for me.
Now, you've both given me kind of a Washington-focused sort of a answer. It's a big country. What beyond the Beltway, to use that cliche, struck you? I mean, to me, it's sort of a Washington thing too, I suppose. But the thing that stands out in kind of a depressing way is this hyper-partisanship, which appears to be getting worse. It used to be in this country that there were always a big number of people who were in the middle, who did not necessarily identify as either Republicans or Democrats or the right or the left. I mean, a big group of independents. And now that appears to be just shrinking by the day, and people are just moving further to one side or another, of course, which makes cooperation on these big issues even more difficult. To me, that's sort of the big thing.
The country is basically divided along tribal lines. There's two giant tribes, the people who adore Trump and the people who detest Trump. And there are tens of millions of Americans in both categories, and you get the feeling there's about 40% of the electorate who adore him and about 40% of the electorate who just detest him. The number of undecideds, you're right, Paul, continues to shrink. And this lack of comity, the lack of being able to work together is amazing. I remember I covered Gerald Ford when he was vice president and then president, and he was a master of getting along. I mean, it's a cliche, but it really is true. Ford used to say, I believe we can all disagree without being disagreeable. And now everybody is disagreeable. I mean, there's name calling, there's no goodwill, and there is precious little goodwill on either side of the political debate or even in the country. And I find it really depressing.
Ford said that compromise, in fact, is the glue that holds government together, and that appears to be disappearing rapidly. Well, let's kind of go beyond Washington and America if we've got a couple of minutes left here. A whole bunch of things around the world just to talk about quickly. Let's just start in Britain. Boris Johnson is going to continue as prime minister, a convincing victory a couple of weeks ago. Quickly, what does that mean in your view for Brexit?
Brexit will happen. That's a certainty. And his election campaign was brilliant. Basically, let's end the misery and get this done. And people said, yes, please stop this endless impasse over Brexit. So they will leave the European Union in January, but that's sort of in name only. They have an 11-month transition period, which experts say will be very difficult to achieve. And so Johnson will likely get an extension on that. So they will maybe go through a new phase of misery, watching the UK extricate itself from the EU without being too disruptive to people's lives. But there's no doubt that the people within the UK who wanted to stay in are in full panic mode, particularly in Scotland and Wales. The Ireland question has now been reopened, and they've got a kind of a compromise set up on that, so that you don't reopen the whole Ireland question. But, you know, the future of the EU is not as gloomy as you might think, in fact. I recently had hosted a coffee with a key member of the European Parliament, Radek Sikorski of Poland, who said that, in fact, Brexit has strengthened the EU. He says that the populists in Poland, in France, in Italy, no longer supporting their country's exits from the European Union. They saw how awful it's been for the UK. And he says the so-called corpse is very lively.
In Israel, with three attempts now to have a new leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, been indicted for corruption, yet he's still hanging on. And I think he won kind of a victory just this week that allows him to keep controlling his Likud party. But the leadership in Israel is far from clear, too, as we head into the new year.
There's almost certainly going to be a third election in less than a year in Israel. The leading contender is a former Israeli Defense Force chief, retired General Benny Gantz. And you get the feeling that power is slowly leaching away from Netanyahu. I don't know whether he survives the criminal trial on corruption charges or not, but it seems like after a decade, his hold on power is more tenuous than ever before. So I think we're going to see months and maybe longer turmoil there, and it's not at all clear who's going to be able to form a government, whoever wins this third election. The U.S. will remain Israel's staunchest global ally no matter what happens. I think President Trump would prefer Netanyahu to survive because Netanyahu has gone out of his way to support Trump. It remains to be seen, and turmoil and chaos in Israel is never a good sign. The people, those who like that proposition, are basically the Arabs.
Now, we've talked about sort of politics in Britain and Israel and so forth and what's going to happen with the EU, but sort of one kind of a more amorphous issue that I wonder about is, so you've got this deglobalization trend, and yet it's bumping up against international issues that it seems to me can only be solved with international cooperation. So it seems to me those are two forces that are going to just create increasing friction at some point. Does that make sense? I mean, how do you deal with things like climate change,
right,
which is not going away, appears to be getting worse,
right,
places like Australia? How do you tackle big problems like that when everybody wants to go on their own?
Well, you're right. There's no doubt that the U.S. dropping out of the Paris Climate Accord is a huge problem for global cooperation on this issue. But you have other forces. You have California, which, if it were a country, would be, I think, the fifth biggest GDP in the world. They have their own climate policy, and they have their own restrictions in place. And even a country like Australia, which is very dependent on fossil fuels and a big exporter to China of fossil fuels, they're still with the program. And their conservative prime minister acknowledges that climate change is, in a general sense, linked to these extreme weather events and to the brush fires that caused him some harm politically. So I think it isn't all gloom and doom. You've got most world leaders believe that climate change is real and have instituted policies to fight it.
Well, give me in our last minute or two here. 2020 is here, just a couple of days away. The big event here in the United States, obviously, is the presidential election next November. We were sort of talking before the show that President Trump has a very good chance of winning. What do you think is going to happen in 2020?
Well, I've said a million times from these microphones, Paul, overnight is a lifetime in politics. And we have 10 and a half months worth of lifetimes left to go until early November of next year. Something will happen that we don't expect to happen. Why? Because it always does. And so it's hard to know. The one thing I believe that President Trump still has going for him, other than a ferocious base of about 40% of true believers, is the economy. There were a lot of worries that the economy would start to slump by now. That has not happened. Still some people who think that that might happen next year remains to be seen, but it's that will definitely be the domestic story. Quickly, I think there's going to be growing competition from China and Russia challenging the president and the U.S. In global affairs. China and Russia seem to be somewhat emboldened, and I think there's going to be more bumps in the relationship between the U.S. and those two other superpowers.
Okay, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor to National Journal, and Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. This program was produced by Carol Castiel, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. This is our last show of 2019. Happy New Year, and we'll see you in the new year.